Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out. Say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And we're not really going to talk about Daredevil because Adam didn't get to it. But I want to briefly, like, you're beating yourself up right before we recorded. But here's the thing.
Oh, no.
It's not bad.
But it's not good.
It's it's weird because there's one episode premiere this week.
Yeah.
Next week, they have two episodes.
That's what I saw.
This is not a show that should have just premiered with this one episode.
Should they? You think they should have gone with all three, maybe?
Yes.
Okay.
Because that now, the opening scene of this episode is I dare say, hallway fight good.
Okay.
For this show, like, it's pretty fucking great.
Okay. Okay.
And there's another action scene where he has to rescue someone towards the end of the episode.
Uh-huh.
It's also extremely well done.
Okay.
Other than that, it is a lot of expositional setup for things and, like, hand-wringing the way this show likes to do.
Yeah.
With one lone bright spot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know, Matthew Lillard is in this season.
Yes, I did know that he was in. Like, he's, like, you know, the Lillard sauce has continued on.
Yes.
To which I'm very excited about. But, and then you saying that is kind of like, okay, yeah.
Absolutely. He's in two really big scenes, and both of them are with Vincent D'Onofrio, and he, like, fuck you, Quentin Tarantino, because...
Of course.
I'm sorry, man. Like, he really, really stands his ground. Like, he's playing a specific, like, kind of Stewmacher type. So, like, I get the argument of, like, he doesn't have a ton of range, but, like, doesn't matter if his range is, like, Stewmacher-esque, like, psychotic and shaggy. Like, if those are the only two real acting stretches he can do, I don't care, man. Those are fun to watch. Like, it's wild because season two of Cross just wrapped.
Yeah.
And he's the main baddie in season two of Cross as well. So he went from, like, co-starring with, what's that guy's name? Aldous Hodge,
yeah.
Cross, who is also fucking phenomenal, to now sitting opposite Vincent D'Onofrio as Kingpin, who's also phenomenal. And he's just excellent. It's, I mean, they're going to have to fuck it up pretty bad for him not to be probably my favorite part of this season. So, you know, we'll see. I think missing, like, you not getting around to watching the premiere is not the worst thing, because all in all, it's ultimately unsatisfying, because when it ends, I was like, why are there two episodes next week and only one episode this week?
Also, you know, this is like a medium take, but I'm going to say it, is that I still feel that Daredevil has been truly mishandled. Like, he's not being handled in the way that I really want him to be handled. Like, the Daredevil
I think this season's going to be better.
I hope so, but also, like, here's the thing. Is that my Daredevil is a swashbuckler. Like, he's the guy that fights the foot.
Yeah.
He's the guy that has this epic love story that can never be with Elektra. and is tested by people like Bullseye, who's a true pure psychopath, like but also like the main component is that he's a swashbuckler. He's like low budget. I mean, he's essentially low budget adult version of Spider-Man.
Why you and I were like two of the only people I know that really enjoyed the bank heist episode.
Yeah.
Like that felt like the swashbuckling Daredevil, and the internet, of course, being as shitty as the internet is, was like, oh, this is not what we want. This is not what we signed. You know, like that's what made him so much fun in She-Hulk.
Yeah.
Was that kind of like cavalier thing. And I get like leaning sometimes to the dark and gritty, but like I am with you, and this show does seem to want to just be the dark and gritty. You know, it wants to be the Batman.
Yeah.
And the Batman is great. But like, I also like a show I've been watching on Tubi. If you don't know, Tubi has a shit ton of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That they pulled from the Warner Brothers catalog. Batman, the Brave and the Bold, the complete series is on Tubi. And that is a show that you could do like a Daredevil version MCU type thing where Daredevil like teams up and have him just be this like swashbuckling hero the way Batman is in those Brave and the Bold episodes.
I'll tell you, Brave and the Bold, I have three of the Batman series on disc that I own. And I personally, like, you know, not including the Justice League animated, but that's completely a different story, right? But one is the animated series, like, you know, the Bruce Timm, Paul Dini masterpiece. The other one is Batman Beyond. And the last one is The Brave and the Bold. Yeah. Because The Brave and the Bold is a certain kind of Batman. Like, and all we've gotten is a certain kind of Daredevil. Like, and you know what it is? It's not even like the Batman. Because, like, the Batman, I feel like, yeah, like, it has that aspect of like navel gazing, but it's so kind of like focused on the procedural aspect. Like that scratches an itch that I don't ever get in Batman movies. Are usually about villains, right? It's never about like the crime and the first Batman, like going back to it, like which I just recently did. What I loved about it was that until it becomes this like the ending thing becomes a big blockbustery type of thing, it is an investigation. It is no different than Seven or Dirty Harry, where you're trying to figure out why a serial killer is doing what he's doing, right? To these political figures. Like, I can deal with that. The Daredevil stuff is just like, it's all Frank Miller, but none of the, like, it's like it is pure undiluted Frank Miller, and like if I've learned anything, yeah, I don't like Frank Miller. Like, like as a kid, it was cool because like when you're 10 years old and you see
when you're 10 years old saying fuck in public with your parents not around, it's like, oh, I'm so cool.
Cool, yeah.
Like, it's not really that. It's like kind of nothing when you're, you know, in your 40s. It's like,
yeah.
This is so annoying.
Yeah, like it's just like, oh, come on, please, really? Like I'm just like, I'm done with this. Like, it really does feel like the baser Miller stuff, because there's a lot of speech of like the other thing that I tried to reread The Dark Knight, and the thing that I hated most was the speechifying, which Daredevil loves to do. They love to have a TV ad that Miller just kind of coined. Like he thought he was.
That is one of the things about Frank Miller's The Dark Knight saga. Like, maybe all of them, but especially the original Dark Knight series, is there's so much dialogue in that. There's just so much talking. I mean, it's boxes and boxes and boxes of like news reporters telling you stuff, and it's like, oh my god, man. Like, I don't need this much. But yeah, it's a lot of like setting itself up and like, look how smart I am, and you know, how I've expanded this world, and Yeah, and Daredevil, the show especially, has fallen into like Matt making these like long, bold, fucking like we're gonna stand our ground kind of speeches, and it's just like that was probably fun in the first season, but we've done this for a while now, and it's just him doing that. Oh, I mean, he does it in the first episode with Karen. Almost twice. Like, I don't think this spoils anything. There's the beginning scene. He comes home. Karen's there. He has this whole, like, we're taking Kingpin down moment, like, talking with her. Then it's the next morning, and he gives, like, almost the exact same speech. And it's just like, we just had this scene, like, 3 minutes ago. What are we doing? But I still, it's not terrible. Like there's, it ends on kind of a, like the only reason there might be two episodes next week is because it ends with a tease for something that made me feel like, oh, the two episodes after this are going to be about this specific thing. And they didn't want to have a 3-episode premiere. So they did 1 and then 2 and 3, but I really think it kind of suffers from not having a 3-episode premiere. So
gotcha. Like, I mean, like, I think part of the reason why I forgot about it was, to be quite honest, like, I was just like, it's such a weird kind of like dip in back into a certain bit of fandom that I'm just not for. And I think that you kind of made it like the, you made it very clear to me that it's still that. I mean, I'm looking forward to Jessica Jones showing up, and whatever other surprises that they have, which we already know this show is kind of set up to where it's like what you see is what you get. Like, you know, we were really excited about certain things that could have happened on last season, but just didn't. Whether it was because of the rewriting of everything, or I mean, just like Frank showing up for one episode and not really being Frank, like, you know, like, you know, which I'm excited that like the Punisher special is actually falling on my birthday. It premieres on my birthday.
Hell yeah.
May 12th is my birthday. So like, I'm super excited about that. So much so I don't know if I've told you this, but I've been slow rolling re-watching the original Punisher series, and I'll make the
it's so good,
dude. It is the best thing that they did on Netflix. Like, I wasn't a big fan of the Daredevil stuff, other than the Wilson Fisk, like D'Onofrio stuff of it all.
He's excellent.
He's he's great in it, and like, you know, it would be amazing. Like, he really does deserve the big screen. He really does deserve to be in the, like, you know, in like the main baddie. Like, if you're going to do a street level Spider-Man movie, he really should have been the main villain in No Way Home. But I already know, like, you know, those are like these weird sci-fi kind of like high level, like Spider-Man really isn't low level street level guy. That's why we're not going to get, like, you know, like I feel like we're not going to get Daredevil in that movie, because never the twix shall meet, you know, and he's like reserved for Avengers level stuff now, because of how popular he is. It doesn't matter, like, you know, he got a cameo, but like in the last movie, but I mean, it was just a cameo, and it proved that, like, everybody was like, who was that? Like, it just proving that the Daredevil fans are just a certain very, 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 very specific corner of the internet. Like, we know which ones they are. We're looking at you, the guys that the Punisher hates. I mean, like, literally, they wrote a show about him, about that piece of fandom, and they didn't get it. But anywho, I will watch next week, and because there'll be 3 episodes, and we will have a discussion next week in regards to it.
Yeah. I'm anxious for what those other 2 episodes will
hold. Bring. Okay. Yeah.
So it really baffles me why they would go with just one episode. Yeah. And then they'd be like, oh, here's two more a week later. So it's whatever.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, come on, let's be honest. Disney has never shown the understanding of their streaming networks. I mean, they really haven't. I mean, I don't get it.
And Disney and Marvel, like in conjunction, were just like, we don't know what to do with Wonder Man. Delay, yeah. Dump it all at once. And here we are, with the announcement this week.
Second season's
coming.
Okay, here's the thing. Like, this is the funniest part about that, at least to me, is that it took you 5 years to make a Vision Quest. Like, by the time Vision Quest, like, I don't think that people understand that by the time Vision Quest gets released, it'll be a 6 years. 6 years.
I mean, how long did it take for
Loki season two? Four years.
Loki season two. And they were like, "Oh, we got a spinoff of WandaVision coming. We're gonna do Agatha. Like everybody loves Agatha. We're gonna do it." And then years pass, and we get it, and like they don't. Not that I loved Agatha all along. I think it's one of the upper shows for them for sure.
Oh yeah,
but they just really didn't know how to promote it. They didn't know what to do with it. They didn't really understand what the show was, it seemed like. They let it be what it was. They just didn't understand how to
capitalize it. How to capitalize it.
And it's bullshit because it's absolutely excellent. And I feel like if that show had come along a year after WandaVision, we wouldn't have had that discussion. Just like if Vision Quest had been 2 years after WandaVision, we wouldn't be having this discussion. You know, it's crazy. Like
I mean, let's be honest, like you put a point on it, which is that they don't know how to capitalize on things because they don't. I don't like, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'll ask you this: do you think that they have faith in these things? It doesn't feel like they do.
I don't. I don't think they do, which is why Wonder Man season two is such a surprise.
A further question: is it Kevin or is it Disney?
I mean, I think it's a little of both. I don't know that. Kevin Feige doesn't have a problem with pushing envelopes and going, letting things kind of be what they are while also like falling in the Marvel mold. Mm-hmm. Things like WandaVision and Echo and Wonder Man and Agatha All Along. Like, ultimately, those things do fit Marvel, but like, sometimes it's to their detriment. Like, Moon Knight doesn't get to be weird enough.
It just doesn't.
Very quickly becomes like a CGI mess. Like three episodes in, like getting into the otherworldly stuff, but it's all just like, oh look, here's a CGI talking hippo that feels like it's out of a Disney cartoon and not a weird show about a fucking mercenary with multiple identities, you know. It's a little bit of both for sure. Disney, I think, is where the marketing falls apart because Feige has been basically allowed to operate independent of like serious studio notes, or had been for a while, and like the failures of Marvel, I think, probably put them under more scrutiny and like, okay, well, we can't just let you have free reign. I mean, I think Star Wars kind of fell into the same thing where it's like, oh shit, the Solo not being a hit, which has nothing to do with how good of a movie Solo is, and everything to do with Disney being like, we're going to put this one out not even 6 months after the last one. And it's just Star Wars fatigue, you know? And but Disney execs only see that as like, oh, they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm very curious about this as well, because it's something that I think about is that is it feel like they're not just like we went on an epic streak, right? Like the first, like, you know, the first 12 movies is like an epic streak of like just, and if we really go back and we really look at it, it's not really a streak. It's just
The Incredible Hulk was not a hit.
No.
Iron Man 2 was a massive hit.
Exactly.
But it also had huge backlash.
Exactly.
Like, huge, there was there,
critical there backlash.
Was, yeah. It made money and that it did what it needed to do, but it did not land the way they hoped it would. And I mean, to be honest, it's kind of a mess of a movie. So
absolutely. But like, are we Marvel isn't bulletproof and they never have been. Are we now seeing that they are just a normal studio? Much like any other, like Disney Animation, like Pixar, after a certain run, when the rose colored glasses come off, are we seeing that they are just no different than a studio thing that dictates and mandates certain things?
So Kevin Feige gave an interview. I don't know how recent it was, but mm-hmm. I just ran across it, and somebody was asking him, I think, about like lessons he's learned in the filmmaking process.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's really, really telling, which is weird because this is a guy who started out working with who produced the Spider-Man movie? Because he was working with them.
Not Avi Arad.
In the X-Men movies. It was Laura Shuler Donner. Right?
Yeah.
No, maybe it wasn't Spider-Man. It was X-Men, and then Marvel was like, hey, go see what the Spider-Man people are doing. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, like, point being, he came up, like, seeing people produce and make films. But, like, in this interview, like, he talked about one of the things he did not really understand when things started going, like being more difficult for him and Marvel. He thought it was just them. He didn't understand that all studios, all productions,
yes,
have difficulties. He's not necessarily talking about failures, just about like setbacks and stuff. You know, which Marvel did have like a very bad string of setbacks.
Yeah.
That caused some problems. But at the same time, you know, he didn't see that other studios were pivoting and kind of just rolling with the punches the way Marvel was trying to do. He only saw it as like, we can't do anything right. And I don't know what the problem is. And really, it was just everybody, every studio faces that. And so it's weird to think he still had a lot of like inexperience there. And it's because it was just that hit. Like the only one that wasn't actually a financial hit was The Incredible Hulk. And they had not a ton to do with that movie. Like, yep, it was part of the brand because clearly RDJ's in it. They wanted to like bring it into the fold, but Universal still does, I think, have the movie rights for the Hulk.
Actually, it got reverted back.
Oh, okay.
Well, it officially reverted back because they actually had an interview with who plays Banner? I can't even think. Why can't I think of his name?
Mark Ruffalo.
Ruffalo, because I kept on thinking of Ed Norton. Ruffalo, where they were like, so are we, now that the rights have reverted back, are we going to officially get a Hulk, full-on Hulk movie? And he was like, oh, probably not, just because Hulk is better as a supporting character than a full-on character, like I still propose to everybody that the kicker is that Sony got to use the Hulk in this movie, and he's going to be fighting the clan with, or the foot, the hand. I keep on saying the foot, man. I that just tells you how much of a Ninja Turtles fan I am. the hand in that scene with Spider-Man. Like, I honestly feel like that's what's going to happen. He's going to take off his gamma ray inhibitor, and he's going to turn into full on Hulk, and we're going to get a Spider-Man and Hulk versus, like, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of, like, that's going to be the center set piece. But don't quote me on that, because I don't know anything. Like, just like I don't know for 100% that Sadie Sink is Jean Grey. But I mean, let's be honest, she's probably fucking Jean Grey. you're right. That makes sense. That makes sense that, like, so much of fandom has put so much on these movies and, like, the legend of it, because, you know, 10 years later, of course, like, you know, we don't ever talk about Iron Man 2, but 10 years later, it's like, oh yeah, well, Iron Man 2 was a big hit. Kids that are now 25 were like 15 and probably not reading the stuff that we were reading and the backlash that we had against it, like, and all of the chaos that production held. I mean, we know for a fact that Mickey Rourke had a huge role, and, like, because of his on-set antics and shit, they literally wrote him out of that movie. That pissed him off. Like, literally wrote him out of the movie. Like, you know, but then also RDJ was flexing his flexing his muscles. He brought Justin Theroux on, who probably never should have been on as the screenwriter. Like, that movie is chaotic because of that. And it all went to shit when they couldn't figure out how to handle, which everybody now knows it, because he's persona non grata, is man himself, Terrence Howard. How they couldn't get Terrence Howard to not take his $15 million or just pay it to him. Just pay it to him.
Yeah, I really wish they had.
Not to say Don Cheadle isn't good. It's just the continuity just, like, I understand the Harrison Ford, William Hurt thing. Like, you had plans, right? So you change them. Like, but, like, not after one movie, right? Like, you paid him. Like, you made that deal. Nobody else did. Nobody told you you had to make a $15 million deal with Terrence Howard. Like, you did. Like,
that was your bad business up front, and not understanding what it was going to take to, like, actually launch this level of shared universe stuff, like the contracts that were going to have to be in place to get this done. Brief aside, I don't know if you're current on Shrinking, but I know you've seen the Jeff Daniels episode, the first one.
Oh, I know. I saw the, like, we might as well get into it if you want to. Like,
I was just going to say, having watched him in this season of Shrinking, I think I love Harrison Ford, and the Brave New World was going to be, like, a bit of a mess anyway because of the constant, like, rewrites and whatnot.
Yeah.
I think you made a mistake not going
with Jeff Daniels,
with somebody like Jeff Daniels, because like, he is such a dick. And I like,
that's a great choice, by the way. Like,
he's so good. So fucking just sadistic, like, with a smile on his face in this season of Shrinking, that I'm like, man, he has not played enough, like, bad guys. Like, not mustache twirling evil bad guys. No. Just like you think I'm a good guy, but I'm really just a fucking bad guy. And yeah, it's like, I was watching, we were watching that this week, and I was like, man, he should have been at like a something somewhere. And bringing up Harrison Ford, I was like, ah, Jeff Daniels would have been perfect in that role, man. Shrinking's yeah. been so good this year that, like, it, and such a tough watch, man. Just
yeah, it's
great, been, but every yeah. fucking episode seems like a just a gut punch right at the end.
Absolutely, and like I know that people have been criticizing this season. Just as a small, just aside, like a lot of people have been criticizing this season because it was supposed to end this season, and we were supposed like they're getting a fourth, and it looks like a fifth season, and they feel like things have been stretched out. But I'm like, how do you like? So you really wanted it like. I understand why it's being stretched out now, because shrinking is never about the dark. It's about the dark, but it adds in the flavor. If you had ended with this season, to be quite honest, I feel like it would have left a bad taste in my mouth, because it's so like these are things that were planted well in advance, right? Maybe Disney saw it and said, like very, very rightfully said, no, we need to end it the way that shrinking should end. We're going to give you a couple more seasons.
I also like, you know, they should end the show when they want to end the show. But I also feel like this is a show that could introduce new characters. Like the way they tried with Scrubs and failed because it all felt so rushed.
Yeah.
Over time, like, I hate to see Paul/Harrison Ford leave this show, but the show can survive without him. I think it can survive without Jimmy. Like, I think you could move this show and like make other characters the main character and like have the show just evolve and evolve and evolve and evolve. I mean, probably creator wise they're not going to want to do that. They're going to want to try to stick with the cast that they have.
Yeah,
but I you know, the show, it's not like Ted Lasso where the show's called fucking Ted Lasso, so there's not a show without Ted Lasso. You just have to make another show with those characters. Shrinking is not like, it starts about Jimmy, but it's really about like I mean, it's about therapy and what it can, should, and maybe should not be.
Yep. Very much so.
I don't know. It wouldn't bother me as long as the conclusions for the characters are satisfying. Like, I don't want the show to end. Just let it evolve. If somebody needs to go, let them go. Yeah. You know, just find a satisfying end. I mean, we've seen Bill Lawrence do it before. Not successfully with Scrubs, but that's more about lack of preparation and trying to last minute go, oh, now the show is this. But I mean, Spin City survived for 3-4 years after Michael J. Fox left.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that's impossible to do. It wouldn't bother me, you know, if this is the end of Harrison Ford's arc, then I mean, so be it. Like, I don't think it is, because he's just been like, I'll do this for the rest of my life. If I die, if this is the last thing I do before I die, I'll be happy. It is what it is there. And also we'll see. The show's been, even when it's not good, it's good.
Like, yeah, no, it's not. I don't think, because it's so character dependent, I don't, like, for me at least, and I was going to ask you about this, it's like, it doesn't feel like this season feels better than last season. Like, but I also feel like this season is a little bit more testy and feels a little bit more, at least to me, to real life, because you're dealing with problems that everybody has, problems with their father, problems with their job. Like, you know, like, yeah, it's dealing with a suicide, but like, I feel like the core issue with that storyline is that you're like, it's about a job that you thought you were good at, and then something happens to shake the foundations of your, the pillar of your foundation.
We're not all therapists, but yeah, we've all been in that situation where it's like, oh shit, I thought I was really good at my job, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, and we've kind of touched on this before, the, like, what backlash there is, I feel like, is because people want the show to just be about Jimmy, and Jimmy's in a, like, maybe not a great place because of,
oh, they just, know, put him in
recent stuff.
Yeah, they, yeah, just put, they just put him into a, like, I would not be, like, I was going to ask you this. Would you be surprised if Jimmy started using again?
I don't know if we're quite there yet, but.
But we're on the way, right? Like, yeah, if it keeps on.
I feel like this could easily be, like, a big step backwards for him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, up until, like, literally the back half of this last episode, like, Jimmy was in a pretty good place.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to make a dramedy about a guy that's in a pretty good place, you know? Bill Lawrence's other show. Well, he's got two others. Who the fuck has three shows on at the same time? Like, what creator? Shonda Rhimes, I guess.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's, like, it. Like, it's him and Shonda Rhimes, and that's fucking it. Like, you Scrub, Shrinking, and Rooster, three different networks, all running new episodes at the same time. It's fucking insane. But to, like, flip to his other show, Rooster, I think one of the problems with Rooster is that, like, Steve Carell's not the dude in Crisis.
No, it's his daughter. It's
and,
his,
and but his, Steve Carell's the main character.
Yeah, like, and
we just keep following him, and he's not the one in Crisis.
Yes. No, absolutely. Like, it's one of those things where you keep on going, when are we going to see the chinks in the armor? Like, and, like, and you put it right.
It's kind of boring. It's just kind of boring. Like, he's great. The cast is great. There's really good moments in every episode. But mostly it's kind of boring because you're following a guy who, yeah, he's kind of hapless and a little bit lost. He just isn't really in crisis. Like,
no,
it's all kind of just manufactured. Like, he is trying to, like, save his daughter, and that's what brings about all of this. But we just cut to her. We're not dwelling in, like, her life falling the fuck apart.
No, it's like
we're only really seeing it through his eyes.
Absolutely. It's like the moment in the second season where, or the second episode where he walks in and then she punches her husband. We don't like it's tailoring the joke to a visual gag rather than, like, in Shrinking where it's all organic because it feels like everybody's an ensemble. Like, this feels like the rooster is not, like, what's the word? What's the college name? I can't think of the, like, cause, like, it's very specifically called the Rooster because his main character in his books is Rooster. Like, and so it is like a Ted Lasso flagship show. It's not like Scrubs or Shrinking where it's about multiple characters. You know, where it's a, like, yes, JD is narrating things, but, you know, Turk and
Elliot
are a part of it, and their storylines are a part of it. It's an interesting, like, you really put a nail in what I'm having a problem with the rooster, which, like, maybe they'll get to, like I know that they're supposed, like, I'm still watching it. It's good writing. It's just, it's very kind of like you said, there's no friction there, right? Like, the biggest thing,
like,
was
even when it's like his biggest thing, and it's probably the best Steve Carell moment, is the student stuff.
Yes.
Like, the way the boobs, they just don't want this guy there.
Yeah.
And like, well,
even some of the staff,
especially that one student.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of that stuff is really, really interesting and funny. And you get like what the show could be. But then the rest of it is just him kind of like tripping in and out of like other people's scenes. And it's like, yeah, but the show could easily just be his daughter is the main character and we're spending all that time with her and he's kind of the background, which actually would be a better show.
Yes. Or like it's all of a part of an ensemble. Like, do you know what I mean? Like it's not, it doesn't like, he doesn't have to be the lead. And maybe, like, the thing was is that I was thinking towards Ted Lasso and how Ted Lasso didn't become an ensemble until the second season.
Yeah.
Like, but also, Ted had a lot of issues, like, right off the bat. Like, we knew that he had issues because it was very much written and embedded in there. We still haven't met his wife, which I know is Connie Britton, his ex-wife, yeah. I should say. So I'm wondering if that's going to be the inflection point where that's going to bring out like all of his particular issues, because his daughter keeps on telling us about these issues, but we're not seeing them. It's like, it's the whole dictum of like, show me, don't tell me, right? Like Shrinking yeah. does that wonderfully. Like Shrinking does that where like, what I love about like the show is that a character will like characters. Like, I think it was William Goldman that said, characters should always be constantly lying about their feelings. He's like, they don't have to lie about the plot. They don't have to lie about other characters, but they should always be betraying how they feel, because that's the way that humans talk. They're always like, oh, I'm fine. I'm perfect. And you can obviously see the cracks in the walls. Right. That's what Shrinking does. Like, that's part of like what makes it so beautiful. Even Ted Lasso did the same thing. Here, it feels like everybody is like face value. Like, do you know what I mean? Like everybody yeah. is talking about their feelings, but everybody is very shallow because they're the most honest people in the world. And I haven't gotten to the point where it's like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I didn't see that coming. Like, do you know what yeah. I mean? Like, yeah. The best parts of the show are when I can't think of her name. The professor's girlfriend who's pregnant, her roommate
yeah.
who keeps on giving, like, she's like, why the fuck are you here? Why yeah. are you here? Why don't you go get an apartment? I know your house burned down. Like,
yeah, but like you're staying
you're staying with a college student. You're with college students. I just want my life back. And it's so true, because I'm like, those two characters, I fucking hate those characters. Like,
yeah.
it's part of the reason why I feel like, if you're going to give me characters to dislike, give me a reason to dislike them. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I also think Phil Dunster's like miscast.
Oh, here. He is like, totally miscast.
I get you wanting to like continue to work with this guy, but like, he works as like the pompous, like fuckboy kind of athlete thing in Ted Lasso. He doesn't really work as like pompous, like
education professor. English yeah. professor fuckboy. Like, no, yeah. he doesn't work.
It doesn't really work for me.
No,
the rest, he's great, but like, I just think it's miscast.
To be perfectly honest, do you know who I actually like? I actually thought of Ted as, like, Ted would have been a perfect, like,
oh yeah,
like an older guy that she married that's basically the same yeah. age as her father. As
her dad.
Like, yeah, how
that amazing, would have been pretty great.
How amazing would, and like, because Ted is so likable and you give him that kind of Derek persona where you're like, fuck, I hate to like you, but I like you, but you're a dickhead. That's how you got that student pregnant.
Yeah.
That's how you married this other woman that you should have never have married. You know, because it's like, there's no tension there. Like, there's literally no tension other than the idiot cop who is the worst written character in the world. He doesn't deserve, he's not even supposed to be a part of this world. Like, I don't get it.
He's from like an actual legitimate sitcom.
Yes. And
this show is not a sitcom. I love that actor, Rory something. And I think he's really funny, but he's not in the right show.
Oh no, he is so not in the right show. Like he is so kind of miscast. I was like, are you kidding me? What is going on here? Especially because I also think that a lot of the cast, like the John C. McGinley is holding back his over the topness, but everybody else is very subdued. This feels more like a drama that has moments of comedy, whereas like everything else Bill Lawrence has done is more of a comedy with streaks of drama. And it's so weird because everybody is so subdued. You're waiting for people to do certain things, like act out, like in his shows. Like, you know, Ted Lasso has those moments, right? Shrinking has those moments. Scrubs has those moments. But this one, it's like, huh, interesting. Other than burning down the apartment, which is more done for, like, and maybe... Like, okay, so, like, I was gonna ask about this. Like, so, is it wrong? Like, it feels like they're leaning into the cringe of Steve Carell's casting and his office persona.
Yeah, but it's not cringe enough. That's the problem.
Yes.
It's not actual cringe. Like, because you're not... You're kind of on his side, which is a problem. Like, the students being shitty and it being cringy for him, like, it's just cringy for him. It's not actually cringe.
Yeah.
He's just like, oh, this is awkward for me. Y'all don't really like my stuff. Like, that's not really cringe. Like, that's just a situation where you kind of sort of feel bad for the guy and you're like, yeah, let me kind of shitty to him for no reason. Like, okay, he wrote, like, popular novels. Like, he's not fucking Mark Twain. Like, I don't know what you want. Like, all we see is this semi-successful author, like...
trying to help his daughter out. Like, that's it.
And so it's not cringy for the audience. It's only cringy for the character. And that's not... And, I mean... Maybe Bill Lawrence is not really good at cringe comedy. Like, it's not really his forte. So, Rooster's kind of, like, it is so far just, like, a swing and a miss. But that doesn't mean that, like, once it does connect, it isn't going to be, like, a grand slam.
Yeah.
It's just, I haven't had it connect for me at all yet.
No.
Meanwhile, like, Scrubs, I'm loving the revival. It is like old school kind of Scrubs. Like, it is maybe a show that's a little like this kind of comedy doesn't really play the way it used to. One thing about Scrubs, and maybe you can put a finer point on this.
Mm-hmm.
Are you watching the revival?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. It was one of my favorite shows. So like,
yeah,
like
we're mine too.
Yeah. Like, so,
the way they're shooting it, like, I mean, literally the lenses that they're using to shoot it.
Yeah.
Are so, and I get like, you're using technology, like you're using what we have, what a lot of people use, but like, and maybe you haven't noticed and I'm about to fuck up you watching the show, but the characters are so in focus and the backgrounds are so out of focus that it throws me. Like, every close-up feels like they're on a fucking green screen.
It, you know what?
With an out of focus background. And it really is just like modern camera work. And me being used to like Scrubs was a three camera sitcom, like just traditional without a laugh track, but it was shot like kind of like most sitcoms. And so like there's always stuff in the background that, and that is not what happens in this version of Scrubs. Like the wide shots, yes, but the close-ups, like the backgrounds are like non-existent.
Yeah. And actually I have noticed that. And it's also it's not just the, so I was doing a little bit of research on this, and it feels like, okay, so like, not to further your point, but it feels like an Instagram filter.
Yes.
Like it feels like it's shot with an Instagram filter. But the thing is,
we're going to put you super in focus.
Yes.
Background's going to be completely blurry so that you are the focus of the shot. And that works on Instagram. It is very jarring to see in a show where they have a minute and a half monologue.
No, absolutely. And here's the thing is that the other series, at first it was shot in 16mm and then it was shot on 35. It's the difference. It's the whole thing of like, and here's the thing is that the reason why I started to do some research on it was because I just as of like 3 weeks ago was watching like, you know, the original Scrubs, and it's shot in such a way that you cannot, it's very cinematic in the way that it's shot. It's very Airplanes 1980. Yeah. And when you think about that, like, or Top Secret or Naked Gun, it's very kind of like the joke is in the background. And, yes. And like,
they use a lot of like cowboy switches.
Exactly.
Just visual gag stuff that you're not going to get in this version of the show because of the way it's shot. Like, again, the wide shots, you can do stuff like that, but that's not where the original Scrubs, like, it's the weird stuff in the background that sometimes made that show really worth, like, the rewatch.
Oh, know? Absolutely. It's the exact reason why you rewatch it, and it's, you keep on going back to it because it's so layered. But here's the thing, is that the cost for shooting 16 or 35 now is just, it's impossible. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, like, productions are so expensive now regardless.
I also wonder if it has to do with, so I know availability
is a big factor.
An issue.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of like, we have to shoot people where we have them. So you don't have everybody on set always at the same time.
Nope.
So especially when you're shooting close-ups, like you need it to be able to stay singular in the shot and in the flow of the show. So that's why you have that like hyper focus, and it's fine. It doesn't, like, it's not truly, truly detrimental, but as somebody who watches old school Scrubs on a fairly regular basis, like it was pretty jarring. But it's still fun. Like,
yeah, it's an updated version for, like, it's not only like written like a 2025 or 2026 show, but it's also shot like a 2025, 2026 show where there's not much, like, there's not like the Scrubs as we know it is no longer exists. And
probably couldn't exist.
Oh, like, no, that. Like, it is.
I just don't know if like that show,
It's a little too wacky. Like, it is from an era, and I think that that's what it is that what I loved about the show when I was watching it is the exact thing that you talked about, the cowboy switches, it felt like a Zucker bro, like a ZAZ. Like, it felt like the Naked Gun. It felt like Top Secret.
The cutaways. Which they do have the cutaways here. And, like, sometimes they're pretty good. But, none of them are as good as the old school ones.
No! You know?
Like, those cutaways were just fucking brilliant. Like,
oh yeah,
almost every time it was like, oh, it's pretty funny.
Kids just couldn't handle it. Okay, so it's something that we've not ever talked about, which is a very big bone of contention for me, is like everybody saying comedy is dead, and I'm fairly certain they're right. Comedy films and comedy TV series in the way that we loved them are dead, because as an example, I'm just gonna throw something out there. A movie like, did you ever see the Jennifer Jennifer Lawrence movie, No Hard Feelings?
No.
Okay. So No Hard Feelings is,
I know the premise.
Okay, you know the premise, right? So like, in a very weird way, this movie is a lot like Risky Business. It's very similar to Risky Business. But when you watch the two, Risky Business is truly like a comedy that takes risks, whereas the risky part of No Hard Feelings is having a CGI completely naked Jennifer Lawrence. Like, that's their risk, right? There's no sex, there's no sex workers, there's no relationships, there's no talk of there's talk of like economy and like salaries and like the desperate need for money, but not in the way that like Risky Business is very smart about it and very kind of shows like the rise of Reaganism and Reaganomics and stuff. But that's to the point to me of like how we treated comedies in the 1980s and 90s. And early 2000s, and the way that we currently treat them now, because we're so afraid of, and I'm not trying to sound like some kind of, like, you guys know me, you know what my political leanings are, but we're so afraid of getting canceled or getting a huge discussion about something wrong, that comedy has lost its, not its bite, but the way that comedy is presented, like for some reason, a lot of reasons, there should be absolutely no reason why Risky Business should exist in 2026. But people still exist in that world. People still exist that are like that, you know, and people like the way that No Hard Feelings softens the edges, where Risky Business was like, no, we're going to make it razor sharp. We're going to make it cut. And we're going to make it something that you're going to remember is the difference in comedy now, at least I think. Like, we're going to be talking about something that's partially comedy, and I like the fact that it has an edge to it. I like the fact that the comedy has an edge to it, and it makes it all the better. But normal comedies, like things that we exist in the comedy realm, are very, and to the point of the rooster, like, are very ho-hum, right?
Everything's so cynical. Like, it doesn't, like, and I'm a cynical person, so.
Yeah.
Like, cynical comedy does tend to work for me, but, like, at the same time, like, we have lost the broad comedy where, you know, like, part of the joke is either that the person is mean and or dumb. Like, that's part of the joke.
Yes.
And we seem to have lost that somewhere along the way.
Yeah. And the bite in comedy. Cause like, okay. So like, here's the thing with Scrubs is as soon as they got rid of Cox, and he made his speech, I was
it absolutely does lose something there. Like, and I've seen the argument that, like, oh, it's because you can't have a character that yells like that anymore at their subordinates. And part of that is true, but mostly I think it's that Rooster was already on, like, in production when, because Scrubs was pretty fast tracked.
Yeah.
And so he couldn't shoot both shows at the same time.
No.
And if Rooster goes the way of the dodo and Scrubs continues on, I can see them writing Cox back into that show, not as a chief of medicine, but definitely in a role where he's there to antagonize the shit out of JD. Like, 100% can see it.
I don't like the way that HBO works. I don't think that they're going to cancel it, especially because
me either. I think it'll a couple of seasons
because they want to be in the Bill Lawrence. Okay, so like, yeah. Here's another thing that's kind of funny that you talk about, like, three different networks. They're all under his Warner Brothers deal. His Warner Brothers right. deal, right?
They're like, just in different places.
They're sold. They were sold to different places. And just like, update, guys. It looks like this deal is going to crash and burn, by the way. Big time. Oh no, no, not his deal, like the Warner Brothers Paramount deal.
Paramount deal?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Well, so Daddy Ellison's stocks are crashing. And then
I did see that.
He doesn't have the juice to pay out. And my favorite part about this is that the worst thing that fucking David fucking cocksucker Zaslav did was cash out his options. He cashed out like $150 million in options, and it was one of the worst things he could have possibly done, because that $1 billion payout that he has is dependent on them selling. If they don't sell, he doesn't get it. And right now, we're in the middle of a fucking war that doesn't seem to be stopping, and it's crashing the market, especially David Ellison's baby Oracle. And Paramount is in the dumps. And they're saying that it's going to be a lot, that it's supposed to be a lot of venture capitalists that are going, nobody wants to touch the deal.
Yeah.
And now the Attorney General in California has started they're like, nope. You're based out of California. Guess what, guys? You can't not do this. We are having hearings here. You can try to do whatever you want to do in Washington, but you can't get through unless you have this here. And basically, everybody's
that's good for everybody. It might still mean loss of jobs because like the. Everybody's crashing and burning, but yeah. like
not the will
is no. more business is but, more places to take your movies and TV shows and
well and then the best part about this is, do you know who they say is the genius in all this? Uncle Teddy.
Yeah,
because Teddy walked away. He was like, and if you remember, he said, you know, there will be other opportunities at a later date. Probably more than likely, there will be other opportunities at a later date for this venture to happen. And everybody thought he was joking, but he saw the numbers. He saw what was going to happen. He was like, there's no way these egomaniacs will not be able to get around their own bullshit long enough to not have some stupid shit like this happen. And so like, everybody's saying that Teddy is probably going to get it at a cheaper rate. And he's going to have the thing that he's going to...
fucking wild, man.
Yep. That he looked at it and he was like, no, we're not going to compete. We're just going to let them... He's like, they looked at the numbers and they realized that if anything happened, if one bad thing for the economy happened and their stock prices dropped below a dollar, because it was like, I think it was at like $14 or $15 a share, and now it's at like $10 or $11. That's just enough for them to not be able to do the deal. And he was like, we could come back and we will get this at a cheaper price. We will get this at like a lower cost than what we were offering.
Zaslav was like, I was out. I thought I was out.
Yep. And like, so I'm like, you know, like there's a lot of me that just is like, is starting to see like, so they have to get the deal done by January or they're fucked. And guess what? It doesn't look like that deal is even going to come close to being done in January because California AG just decided to go hard on them.
That's good news for everybody.
It is. So if you've seen Warner Brothers start to buy a bunch of projects, it's because they're seeing the shit in the wind. I'm all for this. But anyways, that was just a side note. I thought that I'd bring that up because we always talk about how much we hate David Zaslav, you know, because this is like for the longest time, this was known as
the best thing that could happen is that he comes away. He's not going to come away penniless.
No, but
that he just comes away with not even a quarter of what the fuck he thought he was going to get. That would be astounding. One more thing, and then we'll get into like what we've been watching. Well, I guess two things briefly. One, so last week, a creator who I've long loved and admired, met in person, lovely, sweet guy, Sam Keith, passed away. And so I decided this week, Lewy body dementia too, which is just so fucked up.
Yeah.
Like it's the same thing Robin Williams had. He was 63, but he hadn't worked in comics in a while, but I decided to re-dive into his Max series, the Max from Image Comics.
So
I read the first, like, I read the Julie arc, the first Julie arc, which is like 12 or 14 issues, and which was adapted into the one season of the Max on MTV's Oddities that he had. And so I did something I've never done with this series is I read an issue and then watched the show. And then read an issue and then watched the show. So I did this like weird read watch along. And first of all, the fact that the Max is even available, like the series itself, or even the comic, like the comic's kind of hard to track down. Digitally, you can get it, I think. There was a reproduced series from IDW called the Max Maximized, which you can more or less find. It's hard to find the like hardcover collections though. Those went out of print a while ago. I can only hope that like the one positive thing that comes from this is that the work goes back into print.
Yeah. That is an amazing series, by the way.
Yeah. It's so fucking weird. It has no business being in that like initial Image Comics like run. He was one of the, he wasn't one of the founders, but he was one of the first to like hop on board like after the creation. And like Jim Lee posted a in remembrance talking about like that conversation that he and Sam Keith had, and he was like, you can do whatever you want, like, you know, I mean you know, beyond like things that are like, that's disgusting. But, you know, basically like the weird shit that's in your head that you're like, this doesn't make any sense to anybody. You can do that. And he did. And MTV was like, this is weird. We want to do this as an animated series. And I don't think I reckon, because I've watched the series before and I've read all the issues before, I don't think I realized until I read and watched along as I read that, I mean, it is one for one, as it is maybe the most one for one thing that's ever been produced. I mean, there's some changes in the animated series, like in the early issues, he comes across Savage Dragon. They couldn't use Savage Dragon. Eric Larson owns that character. They couldn't use this shark character that's from Savage Dragon. So they basically just have to put a cop character in there, and then mm-hmm. like a weird shark character. And then the Pit, who is Del Keon, he owned that character. The Pit's in like the fourth or fifth issue of the Max. And so they stuff like that they just couldn't use in the animated series because Image was very like, no, you own the rights to that, and MTV was not going to pay somebody else. They were already paying Sam Keith. So he just created new characters but nothing else about the story changes. They just substitute a character. And in a lot of instances, they are just filming his art. Like, it's just the camera moving across his artwork, and it's fucking, it's wild that it exists. It's so good. It's a damn shame it didn't go past one season, but like, Oddities wasn't the success that Liquid Television was for MTV. Mm-hmm. Maybe because it was a little too weird. But the fact that you can get the Max, like, you can go on Amazon and buy it right now. You can buy it digitally or on disc. And it's absolutely worth having. There's one specific, like, story in those issues about a little girl named Sarah that Julie's kind of sort of friends with.
Mm-hmm.
I try to explain the series for anybody who doesn't know what it is, but I don't know if I could. Like, it's just so fucking weird.
It's really hard to like explain unless you've read it. It is almost impossible to like really kind of. It's a very experiential film, yeah.
It's
book.
It's about the things that we always fucking talk about. It's about grief and, you know, regret and
mm-hmm.
like tragedy, and it's just dealing with all of that, but with like this weird superhero otherworldly twist. Issue number 4 is Sarah gets introduced, and it's so ahead of its time because it is about like it's kind of essentially about gun violence in teens, and it's fucking wild to read it now. Like, I've read it so many times, mm-hmm. and reading it now, it's probably the first time I've read it in about 4 or 5 years, maybe a little bit longer. I don't know. It's just like this girl and this gun and like her dark thoughts, and it's so fucking good. So just like I said, that's been on my mind, like him passing. Like, I decided to reread the Max, but like beyond that, like, just like, if you just search this dude's workout, like his covers for Marvel back in the day were always striking to me. Like, I love them, but I was watching some interviews with him, and the shit that he says that he would get, like letters from like quote fans of Marvel comics like begging Marvel to stop letting him draw Wolverine because they hated the way he drew Wolverine.
What?
Like, yeah, but it's because he drew him like this little elf, hairy, like weird dimensioned character, and I don't know, like, I always loved his Wolverine. I love his fucking Ghost Rider. Like, his Ghost Rider,
yeah,
just wild, you know. If you're into weird shit, seek out the Max. Like, even if you don't want to read the book, just, you can digitally buy the entire series of the Max on Amazon. It's like $20, but it's absolutely fucking worth it. Like, it's so weird and wild and fun, and they did such a good job just adapting his work. It's crazy. The other thing, which will lead into what we're talking about, is I got to go see a movie called They Will Kill You, which is essentially like a sister film to Ready or Not, because it's almost the exact same fucking premise. It's crazy how close they are to each other, down to, like, I don't think this is really going to spoil it for you, down to like the reason they will kill you is because they're going to sacrifice you to the devil.
I think it's in the trailer. Okay. So yeah, like, you know, completely understand. Like, yeah. Okay.
The most fun thing in They Will Kill You is the bigger stars, like Heather Graham, Tom Felton. What's her name from the Apple Plus show? What is her name? She's the lady that's in charge of the hotel. Like, she's in the
trailer. Patricia Arquette Patricia Arquette. Yeah.
So yeah, she's a lot of fun. Zazie Beetz is fun. Ultimately, like, there's some really, really great action set pieces. There's a really fun thing. I'll just say there's a really fun thing with an eyeball that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Actually,
the eyeball plays a very, like, they have a plushie of it. I don't know what the thing is, because I'm trying to stay away from that stuff to not ruin it. But they definitely, they definitely had like something with an eyeball, like a plushie and stuff like that. So anywho.
Yeah, it's fun. There's a really, really interesting thing that the movie does. So, like, it takes place in this hotel. It's all in the hotel for mm-hmm. the most part. And there's these crawl spaces in the hotel mm-hmm. that she gets into. And they have these chases in the crawl space. And it's not, like, standing crawl spaces. It's literal crawling. So, like, it's a chase scene. Multiple chase scenes where they're just crawling on their hands and knees. And it's kind of slapsticky and funny. It's okay.
Okay.
It's not great.
I've seen, okay, so like the director, Kirill Sokolov, I actually saw his first film, which is a Russian movie called Why Don't You Just Die, which is very Coen Brothers-esque, but also very kind of like one location. It's a lot of fun. Like, I actually got the Arrow, like I reviewed the Arrow Blu-ray that is like filled with special features. I definitely suggest, if you have the availability of getting this one, like renting it or watching it, because it's, like, it gives him all his short films. It's all ready. I went back and actually watched this because I thought I was going to see They Want to Kill You in theaters. I haven't gotten to see it yet, but it's a lot of fun. That one is a lot of fun and good prep for, I guess, his newest movie, but it sounds like it's okay ultimately, which kind of sucks.
There's some stuff in it that really bothers me, and it's stupid stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, the opening scene is two characters standing in the pouring down rain.
Huh.
Like, it is pouring. And 2 minutes later, they walk into a convenience store and neither one of them are wet. And I know that's not really a big deal, but it kind of is.
Yeah, it kind like, of is.
It's that kind of continuity in the thing that really it happens. Stuff like that happens multiple times, and it would always just kind of throw me. But you know, your mileage may vary. I do think it's worth seeing for some of the bigger action scenes. on the big screen. Like, I don't know how well it's going to play at home. But ultimately, it was not nearly as fulfilling as Ready or Not, Here I Come, which I just saw Ready or Not for the first time a week ago. And so that this is a movie, despite loving their Scream film, this is a movie that I slept on because whatever, I'm stupid. Finally got around to watching the first one. Had an absolute blast with it. You were 100% right. It's so much fun. Samara Weaving is just great.
Yeah, she's my, like, she's one of those people that, like a podcast I follow talk about, like, investing stock in. She, like, big time. And this year, she's got, like, four films that she's in. A lot of them just genre movies. And I appreciate that she's, like, full-on Jamie Curtis, like, of the new millennia. Like, she just wants to do genre films. Like she's the best part of Eeny Meeny. I don't know if you've heard of that one. That one's, like, the driving, like, she's a car driver. It's, like, a romantic thing. Like, she's the best part about that movie.
I want to watch it. I want to watch, it's something, is it some Akimbo something?
Oh, Guns Akimbo. That she's one's in that, right? Yeah, she's in that. She plays one of the kids in Bill and Ted Face the Music. She's in both of the Babysitter movies, which are but she's great in them. Mayhem, I don't know if you've heard of Mayhem, but Mayhem is a is a great little diehard horror film that stars Steve Yeun that I definitely recommend.
And actually, Monster Trucks. I wanted to see Monster Trucks so when it came out, and I never did, you know?
Yeah, so much fun. Stupid execution, or stupid premise, but perfectly executed. And she plays Lady or Scarlet in G.I. Joe Origins Snake Eyes.
Yeah. I never got around to Snake Eyes either.
And she's got this, like, poppy role where she pops in for, like, the first part of the movie, like, the first part, and then is full on in the last part. Like, she does, like, that's my favorite thing, is, like, when a person does, like, a guest starring role where they come in, like, at the last third. And that last third, she's in all of it, right? Like, she's doing action and shit. So, but yeah, she's great. Like, these are films that are built around her, like, just literally built around her.
I think who is it? Plays her sister? Catherine Newton.
Catherine Newton. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they have really fun chemistry.
Yes,
I like the way. And this is one of the things they did with the Scream movies, is, like, even in their own work, they changed things that were in the first one, but they make it understandable why you didn't have that knowledge. Like, in the first movie, like, oh, she doesn't have a family.
Yeah.
Like, that's the whole thing. She's excited to have a family. And in this one, you find out, oh, she had a sister. Like
it's great. Like, it's, but it always, they always find a reason and a way to expand their worlds that is always super smart. Like the way that I think that why I liked their sequel to Scream and like Scream in New York is because it was a natural evolution and it was a smartly written sequel. The same way that Ready or Not is a super smart way to expand this universe. Now, the one thing that was interesting was just how fucking dark they took it, because the first, like, that could be a turnoff to certain people, because especially, like, it's the Sean Housty character. I know the point that they were making, but it, like, at first, especially when he starts beating on Catherine Newton, like, it's a shock to the system. Like, you literally go, what the fuck is happening here? But
I really thought we were going to find out that he and his sister were boning.
Yes.
Like, I was like, we're about to get some Game of Thrones shit in the Ready or Not universe. This is going to be fucking weird, man. Like, it doesn't go that far. So if I have one complaint about the movie, it's that I think Sarah Michelle Gellar's turn to be like, I'm regretting my evilness. I don't like that.
I don't believe like, it.
I really was kind of like, it sounds weird, but I was bummed out she wasn't as bad as, but like, she spends the whole movie being pretty bad.
Yeah.
And then when it's like, oh, you're going to be, you know, subject to my brother's whims, now all of a sudden I'm not so bad and I'm going to help you. Like, if there was some other like sinister turn there right before she bites it, then I would have felt a little bit better. Like, I don't like that you create sympathy for that character. But other than that, like, I think it's a lot of fun. It goes places that every time I was like, how the fuck are they gonna get, like, you just keep riding yourselves into a corner. How are you gonna get out of this?
No, it's truly a wonderful sequel, because it does the work that you want it to do, and it's not a lazy sequel. Like the thing, like, in my universe, in my alternate reality, this makes more money than Scream 7. Because, like, it's the weird injustices of the world that such a lazy movie like Scream 7 is a hit, a huge hit, and Ready or Not 2, which works overtime, not just on the story, but to entertain you. This is a highly entertaining movie. Like, from the get-go, I mean, how do you have a movie where, like, there's a cameo by David Cronenberg?
I was going to ask you, how fucking wild is it that David Cronenberg is Chester Danforth?
But also, like, my favorite part is that you think that it can't get any better in the movie, but the film ups itself. Like, it throws down the card of, like, oh yeah, we're going to have this cameo by David Cronenberg. And most movies, even almost horror movies, would be like, okay, well, we're gonna skate. But this movie doesn't skate. It goes, I'm gonna up you on that. I'm gonna give you a balloon of blood exploding Kevin Durant. I'm gonna
one more, not really negative, but kind of negative.
Uh-huh.
You wasted fucking Kevin Durant.
After the buildup, like, it's kind of funny, but it's also a shame.
It is really fucking funny, because, like, Kevin Durant probably is a guy that we, like, being just nerds that we are, we're like, Kevin Durant. It's not a guy that most people would be like. He's just a guy that would be like, hey, I know that guy. And they, like, building it up for him to have this, like, big moment of he's gonna, like, be Michael Myers in Halloween 2 and try to kill her in the fucking hospital.
Yeah.
Only to have him just explode. It's really funny. It does set the tone super early, but you give Kevin Durant fucking nothing. But I get why you do that. But you almost make up for it for, like, maybe an actor who I do not think gets the fucking props and, like, the parts that he should get, either in drama or comedy, because he's good at both. Nestor Carbonell.
Oh God, yes,
fucking great. And I don't know why he's not in more bigger, better stuff, because he can do dramatic stuff. But, like, he's really fucking funny, man. His ineptness in trying to, like, snipe people in this movie is hysterical.
Oh, dude, like, but also, like, okay, so Okay, so like that goes to the point of them learning lessons about what everybody loved about Ready or Not One. And the peanut gallery of Adam Brody in the first that turns into an entire like room full of idiots talking shit.
Yeah, it's great.
It's brilliant, right? Like brilliant moment, like a brilliant moment of like, let's go ahead and one up this. Like sequels should always be bigger, better, whatever you want to say about them, but they also should be clever. And like it speaks to the cleverness of this thing that you have characters like Nestor Carbonell or Olivia Chang, who's like the person that's trying to like,
I have a way out.
But also like basically is a plot point, but she does so well with that. Like you don't ever think that it's a plot point. Like you go, oh, okay.
The stuff with her kid.
Oh like, my God. Yes. Shit is
so funny. And
Wang Cheng like, Fu. I mean,
you get a guy who like, I maybe he is young enough to be her son, but like he looks like he's fucking 35.
Yes.
And he's playing like a 14 year old or something.
Yes. Yes, like which is great, like it, but it's those kinds of moments, right? It's like the it's the Rajan twins, like in how you're expecting one to expire, but then when it happens, you're not expecting the cowardice turn that happens. And his deferral, and then what happens to him, and further, like it's a brilliant stroke of like writing where you could have been lazy and not had written them something so clever, but you didn't. You decided to write something super clever for them, you know. And then like, but then it also plays to Elijah Wood's entire role in the film, and it makes him so like that little supporting role so much fun for him to play off of. Like it's like, or even like the like you didn't have to write Nestor Carbonell's like daughter the way that you did, but you did.
She's great.
but then you have this great fight with them with the rocket launcher,
Rocket launcher thing was hysterical, man. Like that, I was like, oh shit, like what are you gonna do? She's got a rocket launcher. It's fucking backwards.
But then also like the blind fight and the reason why they get blinded and how that and how that turns out, the needle drops in this, though we're going to talk about a movie that does like even better. Like we'll one ups. but my God, some of the needle drops that they pull in this movie is like great. And like I love that you honestly don't know how they're going to like end it, even though you kind of have an idea. But when they do, and what they say about like, you know, talking about like thematic, like, you know, thematic horror and stuff. And like, it is as sharp as the first one is, but actually manages to be a little bit more savage.
Yeah.
Like a lot more savage.
I think it is more sad. Like the first one feels satirical with like, it does have like the evil, like the hell Satan stuff, but like it's almost like hell Satan, whatever, we do this just because like we got to, it's tradition, and also maybe we die if we don't, like and it feels kind of offhanded, and this feels way more savage. Like Elijah Wood's not savage, but his character lends this, because he's so aloof and just like the situation is what it is and these are the rules.
Yes,
like it helps, it weirdly helps ground it, because like you didn't have that in the first one. Like, even I mean, this one, The Help, is kind of end on it too. But like in the first one, that's the whole, the whole big thing is like, oh, like everybody's in on it. And, you know, well, not everybody, because some of the maids don't know, but
yeah,
you know, the butler is in on it. And, you know, and this, you have like Elijah Wood, who is an accomplice, but not, like, he's not actively participating. He's just there to make sure everybody follows the rules. And he might should be in an Office style sitcom, because,
oh my God, his, yes,
expressions are priceless. It is up there with like some Jim from The Office shit. It'll just cut to him and he just has this look on his face.
The biggest laugh I got was when he knows somebody's going to explode and he takes, yep, the book and he lowers himself.
Closes up and then hides. So he's like, don't want the blood on me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so fucking, or when he like sees everything going badly and he's just like, okay, I'm out.
Yep.
Like,
he backs out. He literally backs out. He goes, oh shit. Yeah. I know. The moment she gets the pen, he knows exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And he like backs up and he goes, oh fuck, this is going to go south in a way that I kind of like the smile on his face is...
Yeah, he has no loyalty to these fucking people.
No, like, because...
His loyalty is to the game and the game only. Like, yes, to the point where, like, she pulls some shit out of her hat and he's like, nothing against the rules in the book. And, and it's just... It's so much fun. One other, like, minor nitpick. Uh-huh. I do think... the first one is, like, it moves.
Yeah.
The first one's like 90 minutes. This is about 15 minutes longer. And I don't think it drags, but I don't think it moves at the clip that the first one does. Cause like, it just goes and goes. Like you, like once you get in, like the first one in the first 5-10 minutes of the movie, they're married and like they're back in their room. And then, you know, he's just like, oh yeah, I forgot to tell you, like, there's this weird thing we have to do. Mm-hmm. And then once she draws the card, which is like 15 minutes into the movie, it doesn't fucking stop.
No, like, no, it doesn't.
This one has like, and I get it. You have to do like, I think the extra 15 minutes is kind of fleshing out the sister backstory thing.
It is, and it also is expanding on the like. So like, I feel like I rewatched Ready or Not before it, and then I thought about it, and Ready or Not 2 gives the villains a little bit more screen time, whereas the Ready or Not the first one doesn't give, like, it gives some time, but you kind of, like, if you go back and rewatch it again, you're going to notice that you kind of want more time with Henry Crizan and Andy McDowell, because, like, and then the chubby guy, I can't think of the chubby guy, and his wife. I can't think of who his wife is either, but, like, you kind of want them to, you got to want them to, like, do some of the, like have a little bit more time with these people, just a little bit more, not a lot, but also I also think that, so I'm gonna like, I think that the best thing that happened to them was that they got fired from Scream 8 or Scream 7, because it forced them into their own style, because I feel like Abigail, like, it kind of starts with Ready or Not, right? But then they get sidetracked with the Scream thing, right? And Scream 6, I think the reason why I like it so much is it starts what eventually becomes what Abigail is, which is a hangout horror film where it's like, it's got all these great character actors that are saying all of these fucking things that you, like, it's a really smart, funny script where a lot of time is spent
not really doing anything in the plot, but kind of doing stuff in the plot. There's a lot of people walking around searching for the horror creature or searching for something while they're talking, right? I love that.
I need to watch
Abigail again. Yeah. It's on Peacock, dude.
I haven't seen it. I never watched it.
Oh, dude, you're in for a treat, because especially Kevin Durant steals that fucking show as this weird French big look. Like, you know how like there's that dude, the dumbass. What was his name in
Dumbass Tony?
Dumbass Tony. He literally is a version of that character. Except for he's Kevin Durant's version of it. It's like Catherine Newton. Like, there are so many people that are in that movie. Like Dan Stevens. Like, watch it. Like, I think that I think that Stephanie will like it, because it's a horror film and it's a true horror film. It's not like, it's kind of like Ready or Not, where it, but it's like, it's 2 hours long. So it like, I could see how you would be like, you know what, it could have been 20 minutes shorter. But when you watch Ready or Not, like if you watch the sequel again, you go, you know what, they kind of perfected the balance. Like, it's an hour 48, an hour 50, like Ready or Not 2. They got the balance right, because they go way, they go a little bit over in Abigail, because they're just so in love with these characters, which I love. Like, I love that they write these characters that they fall in love with, and they write these like great roles for these characters. Which, how excited does it make you for their Mummy?
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. So it looks like their next project is the Mummy. Brendan Fraser coming back. Everybody.
Yeah.
Coming back. It's exciting. We know they can play in worlds that they didn't create.
Yep.
We know that they can... People will disagree with me. They can improve on worlds that they didn't create. They can expand it. They can do things that you, like, you know, really hadn't thought about in that world. Like, we saw it with Scream. I really think their two Scream movies are two of the better sequels. And I will, you know, die saying that Scream 6 is, like, peak. Like, it's probably in the top three. Like, it's really fucking good. Only problem is you have to have seen all the other movies
to understand why. It truly, like, you have to understand the low of 4
right
to understand the high of 6. Right. Like, you know, the joys of a sequel. Like, absolutely.
I think they're going to kill the Mummy. Like, I think it's just going to be phenomenal. That they've got an eye for action. Their dialogue works. It's definitely the kind of thing you want to see from the Mummy. It's that snappy one-liner kind of dialogue, but it's not super, super cheesy the way, like, some of the old, like, 80s stuff.
It's sarcastic. Like, it's Shane. Like, if they ever got their hands on a Shane Black script and they rewrote it, I wouldn't be mad, because they would probably make it even better. Like, do you know what? Like if they if all of a sudden they decided to remake The Long Kiss Goodnight, oh man, that would, like, with Samara Weaving, like, you got me. Like, and Michael B. Jordan as, like, if you did that combo, fuck, man, you. Sign me up for 10 of those.
Because I also think it's really, really positive and telling of, like, if you look at their history, they work with the same
people. Yep.
From film to film. Like, there's always some carryover.
Yeah.
If not, like, carryover from 2 or 3 films ago. And I think that really, like, it says something that Kevin Durant was a big part of their last movie and showed up for what amounts to a cameo in Ready or Not 2. Like, he's not a huge star, but, like, when you can get people like that to just be like, oh yeah, you're doing this? Yeah, I'll show up. And, like, it speaks volumes to, like, you know how to be with actors. And I think that's one of the reasons like the Mummy franchise just didn't continue, is like you lost one of the main cast members, and it just, it felt like a studio just making a movie and not like a bunch of people getting together to hang out and look what we get to do. We get to go have fun and play pretend.
Yeah.
And they really seem to get that. I mean, you do see that a lot more in the horror genre, but it's still like, it gives me a lot of hope, like for who might show up in the Mummy movie and also for what's going to come after the Mummy movie.
Right.
Because if you've got Rachel Weisz and Brendan Fraser and John Hannah, and if you've got those people, like what are you doing next? Can I be a part of it? Then
that's exactly
fun. Well, that's like, exciting.
Like you got guys like Dan Stevens, like, you know, like who, like it's weird because it's like these guys like have slowly kind of built the kind of films that you want to see, right? And I know that people are going to look at the whole Scream 7 thing as like oh man, they really fucked up. And I don't think that they did. I think that them not being able to do Scream 7 and going off and doing Abigail and then doing Ready or Not 2 makes, like, I don't want them on Scream 7. I'm kind of glad Scream 7 happened the way that it did, right? Because it allows for something like The Mummy, where I want, like, I like now that I've seen what they can kind of do in the horror realm, like giving them a franchise like this is kind of like you said, it's the stuff afterwards. It's going to be the casting. Like, it's going to be a lot of fun to see who they get to cast, who are their regulars that show up in this, like in this sequel. Like, and then I kept on thinking about it because it's going to be like appropriate, like it's going to be like adjusted appropriately. They're going to be in the late 50s, early 60s. Yeah. Like, what if they do like the whole Rocketeer Hollywood thing where
I'm here for it.
Yeah, I know. Like where they go to Hollywood to make their movie, like, and they're like in a cheap Hollywood, like Universal Mummy movie where it's like slow moving and shit. Like,
I mean, that's right up their alley. Cause yeah. You're talking about like fandom, which is something they kind of like excel in, like a la Scream.
Yep.
And, like goofiness, like adding some horror to somewhere, not where it shouldn't be, but where it's just like it's playing in on itself. They're extremely good at that. Like a Mummy movie that the conceit is basically like Poltergeist, where it's like, oh shit, you just got a real mummy. You yeah. didn't fucking like, you didn't think this through. You're like, oh, well, it's cheaper for us to just get a real mummy illegally than to fucking like build a fake one. And then all of a sudden, like they're running through 40s and 50s Hollywood, like with this like fucking cursed mummy, like tearing up Tinseltown. Like that sounds amazing. I mean, we don't know.
We don't know what's going to be like the plot. Yeah.
But that sounds absolutely amazing.
I hope, like, there's a part of me that, like, I know it sounds wild, but, like, a guy that I want them to bring into their fold now that he's done with, and you probably already know where I'm going to go with this as soon as I say it, that he's done with the Righteous Gemstones is Danny McBride.
Oh, yeah. I would love to see Danny McBride, like, working with those guys,
right? He's like the right tone, like yeah. He's the right tone, he's the right kind of willing to make himself a fool but also yeah. like understands the genre. Like I don't know, man, like I get really excited when I think about the Radio Silence guys and what they can do with the Mummy, because the Mummy is like one of my favorite like early 2000s series, right? And like the third one is the one that just The Grave Injustice. Yeah.
I mean, the second one's like has its moments of like, it doesn't really work now.
Yeah.
But you still have that core cast there that kind of really helps sell the like shit parts of that movie.
Exactly.
The first Mummy is undeniably excellent. Like, oh, man, it is
such a great movie.
So fucking good that it's so good that I don't understand how Van Helsing is as bad as it is.
I don't, like, you know, when you're young and hungry, like, I mean, like, also, like, okay, so, like, let's have a brief conversation about the Mummy, which is, like, first off, Class of 99. We both know the Class of 99, minus a few exceptions, like, we're looking at you, Phantom Menace, though, you are getting your comeuppance, because trade routes are seriously a fucking thing now. Jesus Christ, George. Were you a truthsayer? Like, I love that George is always silent about these things. Oh, well, if you think that way, you think that way. But kids should learn about trade routes. I mean, literally, like, fucking, like, it's the Class of 99. I also think Stephen Sommers, like, you know, he puts all of his heart and soul into Deep Rising.
Yeah.
And it bombs, and he goes, fuck you guys, I'm gonna prove you guys wrong, makes the Mummy. But then, I mean, if you look at his movies, like, I mean, he literally does Van Helsing and he does G.I. Joe. Like, and G.I. Joe is, it's a thing, man. Like, have you watched that movie recently with its biomech suits?
Yeah, it's not great.
Like, you, like, and this was before Channing Tatum became My Name is Jeff, right? Like, it's like Channing Tatum, I want to be a tough guy. Like, it would be different. Like, I almost want Channing Tatum to be in G.I. Joe now, because My Name is Jeff, like, Channing Tatum would be so much more fun as Goofy Duke than he would be. That's a funny thing. I want to actually coin that. Goofy Duke.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, I think he had two movies in him, right? Like, he literally had, though you can say his Disney movies are a lot of fun. His Adventures of his Huckleberry Finn and his Jungle Book, they're okay.
I think Odd Thomas could have been good, but yeah, it suffers from, like, a lack of budget, and also the fucking star died.
I know. It's wild that he has Willem Dafoe in that movie as the main bad guy. Like, yeah, like, how did you get Willem Dafoe to be in Odd Thomas? Like, was he an R.L. Stein, or I'm sorry, was he a Dean Koontz fan? Was he going, like, or was he just like, pay me my money? It's wild. Like, but also, like, I'll take that one great Mummy movie and two horrible ones, or one semi-okay one and one terrible one. Like, if it just means that I get that one Mummy, because it is so,
it's so
damn good. And it proves to me, and this is something I think is a great segue into talking about Mike and Nick and Alice. Is that the Mummy has great chemistry between its two leads. And I feel like it's becoming rarer nowadays.
I mean, really? I mean, three leads. Like, Hannah is a third wheel.
Yes.
But he is, like, this weird linchpin. Like, you need that kind of comic foil thing. And the dude that played Benny is coming back.
Yep.
Arnold Vosloo's coming back. What's the other guy with the fucking hair that's absolutely gorgeous? I can't think of his name. He's the dude that's on the hunt with them.
Oh, Odette Fair.
Yeah, Odette Fair. Yeah, he's coming back. Like, yes. it's
who's fucking only aged like 5 years. Like, yeah, you see, like, I'm like, damn, weird, dude. Man.
Like, it's one, it's like, it's him, like, Paul Rudd, fucking Nicole Kidman.
Yep.
Like, it's just like, y'all don't age. You're just drinking, like, children's blood, aren't you? but yeah, so yeah, jump into, so we also both watched a movie called, shit,
you Mike, just said it. Mike and Nick and Alice.
which is on Hulu/Disney+. And it stars our favorite fucking actor. And I like, he's also on the list of like, I don't understand, not that he's not a big star, but I don't understand how he's not the biggest fucking star in the world, because like, I love James Marsden, man.
Jimmy Marsden, like, man. The goat, man. Like, just like between him, like, and that's what I was talking about when I was talking about chemistry between him, like him and Aliza Gonzalez are like,
yeah,
like I'm going to watch that movie 50 times because their chemistry is amazing. Like, when like they make that Steve Winwood needle drop not funny, like it's funny until they start
fucking budget for the music for this movie, because every scene has a needle drop of like, oh, this is a song that was not just like, oh, I know this song.
No,
this was like a number one hit.
This was iconic for our generation. My wife like looked at me afterwards and she goes, well, that's like the elder millennial, that's like the elder millennial or late Gen Z like playlist from all time. She's like, that's gonna be like a soundtrack I know that you're gonna buy on vinyl if you can. I'm like, yeah, you're goddamn right.
The song is a fucking banger, man. I was like, it is crazy.
Like, and then they go into like, and the best part is that they go into like weird dives into different parts of music in that era. Like when they played the, like, I knew that this was my jam, and I know it's super late, but it was like, yeah, this is my fucking jam, this is my fucking movie, is when he, when like, it's also written and directed by Ben David Grabinski, who has been circling like, you know, greatness, but I think this is his first like truly great thing. When he does the Blade, he doesn't just do the Blade reference from the first Blade, but he drops the song. He drops the fucking...
It opens with Ben Schwartz singing Billy Joel's song from fucking Oliver and Company.
Oliver and Company, which... Oh, okay. I now know why you sold it to... Like, I know why you sold the script to 20th Century Fox so you could get that song in there, because I guarantee you it was written into the... As soon as I heard it, I was like, no, they're not gonna fucking... Really? Oliver and Company? But then, of course, it has to be all... Because like, that's the kind of movie it is, right? Like, it drops these needle drops that are just wildly appropriate for like our age group, right? Like, it makes sense. Like, but I mean, further than the, I think that what's funny to me is that as good as the needle drops are, I feel like the casting and the writing is
a perfectly cast movie.
It really,
Vince Vaughn doing like, hey guys, I can do dual roles too.
Yep.
Like, and doing a really bang up job. Speaking of people that don't age, Keith David, like
90-year-old Keith David,
getting to be like a drug kingpin kind of thing. Like, not that we haven't seen him as a bad guy before, but like, this is so goofy and over the top, but also evil. You know, like, I love the bit where the dude spills the drink on him.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
He's just like, hey, it's a party, it's okay. And then, like, he looks at his goons and he's talking to Jimmy Tatro,
yeah,
his Jimmy boy. And, like, you just see his goons, like, beating the shit out of the guy in the background. Like, and Jimmy Tatro, talk about a guy that, like, just shows up and does what he does best every fucking time.
Yeah.
Like, when he gives him the golden shotgun, he's like, oh, that's awesome. What does the JB
stand for? Like, oh, my God.
Fucking, like, it's crazy. And Arturo Castro.
Yes.
As, dumbass
Tony. Yep.
Like, it's so fucking good. And, like, Louis Tan, like, people that are in this movie for like 2 minutes, Louis Tan, Steven Root, and Dolph Lundgren, and Ben Schwartz, like all fucking great. Like, it's such a good cast.
It really is. I mean, well, like,
to the point that, like, you don't have enough for everybody to do.
Well, it's also like Emily Hampshire showing up for like two minutes.
Oh, as the cop
who's like, who has like the whole embedded thing of like, they're going to have a relationship. And like, you know, and then he's like, but I can't ruin it for future or for present the Nick.
Fucking scene of her just going into the party
and pulling and
planting the weapons is so good.
Yep.
And just weird and funny and just like
fucking,
when
fucking
she puts the grenades into the fucking fridge, that's and where, he's just like, that's where I keep my grenades too.
Because like, I don't want anybody getting them either. I'm like, what the fuck, dude? Arturo Castro, so fucking hilarious. Like, he gets some of the best lines. Between him and Roid Rage Ryan, played by Louis Tam, like, it's oh my god, dude, fucking so good.
I don't think it's quite up there with the one from a few years ago that I think was also maybe on Hulu, it was Palm Springs,
right? Palm Springs, yeah, the time loop movie.
I don't think it's quite there. It may be, like, it's weird that we're not fully 3 months into this year, and two of the best movies of the year are about
time travel.
Yep. But I don't know if it's right, if it's close enough to Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. I think it might be a little bit more fun, like, overall. Because, like, the end of Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die gets a little too Matrixy, you know, where it's like, this is kind of depressing. And this, like, has its little, like, kind of sad moments, like, especially the fucking Don't Look Back in Anger in the car. Like,
oh yeah,
holy shit, man. Like, it's fun and funny and, like, also heartbreaking, like, all in like a 2 minute span. It's crazy. It's a really, really good movie that I'm disappointed we didn't get to see on the big screen.
That was my thing, is that I was like, are Disney, Hulu, and 20th Century Studios, like, or is 20th Century Studios at a point now where they're only allowed to release certain movies? Like, are they only got, like, say, 5 to 10 movies a year that they're allowed to release? And so they have to be very cautious about what they release, because Disney just won't let them. They're like, you're our adult arm, so you can release R-rated movies, but you're only allowed to release 5 of them. And one of them is the Neil McDonough movie. The next one is Ready or Not 2, because you want to keep the radio silence guys, because even if it doesn't make money, you want their next R-rated horror movie after they get back from Mummy Land, right? Like, so you're trying to keep these relationships, but also, like, you made a banger. Like, this is the thing, is that you made a banger that if you gave the right push to, it could have been a groundswell hit. Like, it really could have been. Like, you know, you release it in limited theaters for like you do what they did on Ready or Not, is that you build it up. Like, I don't know if you remember, but Ready or Not, the original, what they did was they started it with preview screenings, and then they said, if you want this to come back into theaters, like, you know, like, let us know and post to your socials. And it was such a groundswell that they eventually released it in like 2,000 theaters, and it made like $30 million. It made, like, for a movie that had no cast in it, like literally, like, Samara Weaving was like nobody at that point. Like, she hadn't done her work. I feel like they could have done that with this movie. Like, the soundtrack alone could have carried it.
Yeah.
Like, but you have this, like, it's a movie that works because A, it's brisk, but B,
what happened?
It has,
there you go.
Oh,
okay. I think I lost you for a second.
Oh, damn. Okay. But it works because it's charming. the cast is like on full on, like, we're going to do this. But also, like,
yeah,
it's a well-made film. Like, how do you not release that in the theaters?
It's got such a like hook to it that there's a few like wonky action parts.
Yeah.
But overall, like, I think, especially like storming the party, like I think that that scene is incredibly fun. And you know, I don't know. We definitely need more James Marsden. I do feel like he has been a little bit of everywhere over the last 4 or 5 years, but every time I'm just like, I fucking love this guy. I love this guy.
He, like
the chloroform bit with him and Vince Vaughn was so funny.
Oh, it was like, hilarious.
What
do
you
mean
you don't know what chloroform is?
Yeah.
Like, have you ever seen a movie? Yeah, I've seen lots of movies.
Like, the wet rag thing.
Oh, you mean
thing.
The wet rag thing?
Yeah.
Like, why would you call it that?
I just like it's like or the Stephen Root scene. Like the amount of
that's
joy.
That's the one scene. Like, it's really funny.
Yeah.
But it felt a little wonky.
I think it was the editing of it because you want.
I think I lost you again.
Oh, shit. Hello? Are you there?
Hello?
Are you there?
Well, shit. Yeah, now you're back.
Okay.
maybe that's a sign.
But like, yeah, like, but also like the guy who really plays the fucking the assassin, it's like a cameo.
Yeah, I was like, when it's Stephen Root, I was like, oh shit, that's awesome. And then when it's, you're like, oh, it's not really him, it's like, well, who the fuck did they get to play the guy? And then it's like, oh, it's Dolph Lundgren here for 5 seconds.
But also he brings it though. Like, you like, you go, oh shit, this fucking dude is scary. It's like, I really enjoyed the hell out of it. Like, it's a Saturday night at home. You pop the popcorn, you get your sugar-free candy, you know, sugar-free candy. I have that shirt, the Cronenberg for President, which is so ironic. Yeah. I have that. I actually own that shirt. Which made me do the Leo DiCaprio pointing thing.
I've got that. I've had such a good time with movies that most people probably just, you know, overlook because we're, you know, coming right off of Oscar season, so people are still talking about, you know, all of that shit, and I'm like, yeah, but these movies are so much fun, man. And I really wish this one had been in the theaters.
I do too. Like, this is like a Saturday night movie. Like, this is like a Saturday night. You take your girl with you on a date. You go to eat dinner before and you go see the movie. And then afterwards you're talking about how much fun it is and all the different scenes. And it's just like, it's what movies used to be.
Yeah. And it's definitely going to be, I think it's a perfect antidote for like, if you want to avoid the cinemas next week, because guess what? The next week, probably the next 2 weeks, because I don't think anything's coming out the week after either.
No.
Is all about one thing and one thing only, and that's Super Mario Galaxy.
Wait, didn't you hear they changed the name? It's now called Star Fox.
the Star Fox spoiler, like, it's wild to me that you spoil that like right before your movie premieres, but like I get you're using it to try to like drum up every last bit of, but, and hey, it's Glenn Powell.
Yeah. That's the thing.
Who better to voice Star Fox?
Like, that's the thing, right? Like you have to announce that because that gets people excited, because like the people like me who I'm like, fucking Chris Pratt again on this press tour. No. Oh, shit.
Hello? Are you there? Hello? Hello?
You there?
Yeah, I am.
Hey, it keeps dropping out. All right. So we'll end on that. That way we don't have any more technical snafus. Next week we're going to be talking about Super Mario Galaxy.
Yes.
Until then, go check out everything else we do over at xwingfiles.com or written work over at Adam's website.
TheMovieL.com, where we got a ton of new reviews, a bunch of new reviews coming out. all 4K, all great.
And we'll see you guys next week. Star Wars, number 2, comics, number 3, Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, number 4, Mario, number 5, Weird Al, number 6, Batman, number 7, Cal, number 8, Simpsons, number 9, TV, number 10, every single band that has stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say hello together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything.